I think you made this joke last time. This is my pod. There are many like it, but this is mine.
This is my pod. There are many like it, but this is my own. And then I shot you.
You know what that means, folks. Wow, energetic opening on today's episode. Things have been so crazy for both of us, but we're working through it. Working through the tears.
As I slam a beer I just picked up.
Yeah.
We're doing okay.
Hustle grind culture over here at Lomo Media, not by choice. But we are here, and I'm very excited. We're talking about it's Full Metal Jacket Day. We're talking about Stanley Kubrick's Full Metal Jacket. This is the 8th episode of the season. Only a couple more left in the... Only one each in the Carpenter Kubrick catalog for us.
Yeah, we're almost there. Season almost over, and then we get a little break. A little break-ski.
Breaky-poo, and then I have a very good idea, I think, for next season that we've talked a little bit about. But we'll have to revisit, so we'll see. And that, definitely, of course, means next week we will be talking about In the Mouth of Madness from Carpenter, as well as... Oh, I guess this is time. You know what? I'm going to save it till the end. I'll save it till the end.
Mm-hmm.
I will announce. We have a holiday surprise for everyone. So without further ado.
Let's say surprise.
Surprise. No, as they say in the motherland, Italy. Surprise.
Hey, so this was your first time watching this, right?
Great question.
Was this your first time watching all 7 parts of this movie together, is what I should say.
So I do seem to remember the first half of this movie. How could you not? But I got this movie mixed up with Platoon all the time in, like, mm-hmm. high school. And my gut feeling is that I did see this, like, in high school, but I don't really have a recollection of it outside of the iconic Arlie Ermey stuff. Get that name right, Arlie Ermey.
Yep.
Which I may have just remembered from seeing, like, pop culture clips and stuff. So I couldn't tell you. This is definitely, but the first time I've seen it where I've been able to appreciate and follow it. Mm-hmm. But I understand for you, this is like a movie that you've seen many times.
Oh yeah, this is probably, I'm gonna say, conservatively, maybe my 5th time watching this film. Maybe. 4th or 5th, I'd say.
Wow. When was the last time you watched it before now?
Maybe 3 years ago, three or four years ago. So it's almost a fresh watch again, you know?
Yeah. I want to not put the work on you for leading the podcast, but in terms of war films, I think that I have a feeling, I don't know how many you've seen, but I have a feeling that you've seen more war films probably than I have. And so I would definitely like to defer to you in the conversation as we go in terms of how this compares to, you know, not just movies that are Vietnam films, but war films in general.
Yeah, I mean, when you talk about war films, I think, I don't know if you've seen it, but the one that comes to mind is the most recent one, 1917. And when you talk about, like, real war films, when you want to compare them, that one about World War One and kind of that, kind of whole the one take, even though it wasn't one take, that whole one take, but that was a really good war movie as well. That I'm in recent times, if anybody hasn't seen that, a strong recommend to go see 1917. I thought that was well done. But as far as this one is concerned, I really want to know, like, I want to hear it, man. I want to hear what you thought, because I've been dying to hear the Aaron review, the Aaron thought piece of this one.
I thought it was great. I would agree with the, I don't know, you know, like, how much reading you did into, like, how this movie was received or kind of what people like and don't like about it, but there's, like, one common criticism that I would agree with, but when I say that, it isn't even, like, that it has nothing to do with my enjoyment of the film, because I think the film is great. And we're used to this with Kubrick. The thing is, he's kind of has a habit of splitting his movies into these, like, as opposed to a traditional 3-act structure. You know, earlier you said something about, like, 7 parts of this movie, and to me, it definitely feels
it's at least 4 parts. like that you can clearly define as four different parts of the movie. There's at least four distinct different parts of this film.
For sure. And we, I think Clockwork Orange, we talked about how it feels like it's kind of split in half between, you know, pre Alex, going to jail and like post rehabilitation. So for me, the only quote unquote complaint that I would have, is that I do think the second half of this feels a little more traditional, compared to what Kubrick would usually do. Like it kind of goes from being something that is very iconic and unforgettable, with the training camp stuff, into something that is not by no means bad. I mean, it's literally like the best pizza you could ever have. It's like, wow, this is really good pizza. Like it is, it's still pizza, but it's really good pizza. And so I do kind of think like that second half did kind of feel more like a traditional war story, which is totally fine. Because I guess I'll stop rambling here. I guess my take would be that the beginning is iconic. Everyone knows that. Second half, I was like, yeah, okay, all right. This is like just a solid piece of war film. But it is about like the horrors of war. And the very final sequence, watch the movie, obviously, spoiler. The final sequence of Joker killing the teenage girl who was shooting at them, and then into the Mickey Mouse chant as they are leaving at the end of the film, I thought was extremely, extremely effective. Like that pulled me back into it, being like, oh, this is like a Kubrick thing, because it is
100%.
It feels, it's interesting because I've seen other war movies that are more gruesome, purposely, you know, gory or brutal, but those movies don't carry the same emotional weight that I think this one does, and this one really nails it when it comes to this, you know, take a life.
Yeah, at that final scene, you see Joker's transformation. I mean, when he's in boot camp and he's getting screamed at, you know, he's like, give me all your war face. He's like, that's not gonna cut it. He's like, what are you? He's like, I'm born to kill. You know, and then he writes it on his, you know, his helmet. You know, he's trying to point out the irony of war. He was never really intended to really say that he was a killer. He's just pointing out the irony of it, you know, with this peace sign, a medallion he had on throughout the film. It's just interesting to see his full character arc at that final scene when he has to finally take a life. He's been in combat. We don't really see him take any lives, but the final scene is the full transformation of Joker when he has to put that pistol to her head and shoot her out of killer. But it's also even that is ironic too, because he's taking a life that wants to die in that situation. He's not taking a life just for war. So you can talk about it's like, you know, did he take God the life for war, or did he take God that life just to kind of put her out of her misery at that point?
Yeah, you know? And I think that's the ultimate point of the movie. I love that duality of like the peace sign badge and the born to kill on his helmet, because you can tell that he's, you know, this I feel like it's important to mention, not that I don't know what our listeners believe in or think, but Kubrick said that this wasn't like a political movie. It was just about the horrors of war. Like it wasn't,
and it really details that.
Yeah, it wasn't supposed to be anti-war per se. I think that the takeaway to me feels pretty anti-war.
It's very anti-war, I think, but
yeah, like, it's more so than that though. It's kind of just like, well, you know, what these people go through, the abuse that these people deal with. Obviously, the big, you know, first portion of the film being kind of this brainwashing and removal of individuality of these soldiers. But I think what I love about the ending, I guess we're kind of doing this almost reverse, but I just love the ending so much. I think it doesn't really matter. I mean, I personally think that he took her life, because it was the right thing to do in that situation. He was being empathetic. But it doesn't matter whether you're doing it for the right or wrong reasons. It's just about the baggage that comes with taking a life, regardless of the reason.
Mm-hmm.
Especially when you're not one of those people like Animal, the animal mother, wasn't that
Animal Mother? Yeah, Animal Mother.
Somebody who is, you know, so gung-ho about killing. You see that throughout the movie. There are these people that are that
so gung-ho that he even puts his whole platoon at risk, you know, thinking that, you know, we're sitting here talking about the end of the scene when you're when Joker has to take a life and how much is one life worth. I mean, Animal Mother risked the whole safety of the, you know, the whole platoon. And, you know, we see Cowboy get killed. We see all these people get taken out by the sniper. And for what cost? You know, right. There's really like, you know, we talk about the cost of war throughout the film, but the cost of running in there, guns a-blazing, you know, you risk all of your leaders, you know, in the platoon.
And I think similar to what you said about him, you know, pointing out the irony of Joker, but his character pointing out the irony of war and writing Born to Kill on his helmet, he was never gonna be that person. And even after, not Cowboy, but who is the leader before that is killed?
I forget his name. I just remember Cowboy.
Yeah, so the previous captain gets killed. When he's killed, or maybe it is Cowboy. Either way, the moment is when Animal looks at him and says, like, do you want to get some payback? And it's this straight-on shot of Joker, and you see the pin, and you see Born to Kill, and in that moment, he's like, hell yeah, like, yeah, like, let's do it. And it's, like, him making this conscious decision that, like, I'm gonna get a piece of this action, like, you know, they just killed somebody who was in my squad, so, like, we're gonna, you know, and then to compare that to the end of the movie where he actually is, like, not forced, but isn't put in the position to actually take a life, it just goes to show that even when he thinks that he is able to do it, it's kind of like when my dad, this is, I don't know if this is fucked up or not to compare, but when I was younger and my dad's a big hunter guy and took me out hunting, but he was always really good about saying, like, if you don't think you can do it, if you don't think you can kill an animal, don't do it, because it's you're going to, you know, it's not like something to be taken lightly, you know. And I don't know, I only went out a few times, I never shot a deer, but I don't know that I would necessarily feel great about killing an animal, let alone a person. I know it's kind of a weird analogy to make, but it's this thing of, like, it's easier to tell my dad or somebody who wants to go hunting or something, oh yeah, like, I could definitely shoot an animal, you know, it's just hunting, easily, you know, I could do that easily. And then when you're in that situation, it's a lot different. You know.
Well, I mean, it's a very different situation, but at the end, you know, obviously, spoiler, if you couldn't figure it out, neither Aaron or I are going to be military experts. None of us have any experience in the military. I've had family that served, but I don't know what that's like. So we can only talk about it based on the movie's perspective and what we feel, you know, as movie buffs and critics of sorts, and talking about it that way.
Players of risk.
Yeah. Players of risk, world conquerors, you know, nothing too big. But no, I remember when I'd go hunting with my grandpa too, I had no problem, you know, with deer hunting, because I actually ate the meat and I felt like it was fulfilling a purpose.
Well, and that's so maybe where my, not hypocrisy, but I guess that's kind of like the line is where ethically I don't have an issue with hunting. I'm not taking any kind of like anti-hunting stance, because you know, my dad was deer hunting and turkey hunting, and I agree with you. I think the meat's serving a purpose. He always, you know, does all kinds of food with it, and we eat it, and I enjoy that. I just think that, and again, this is like not to compare hunting to war, obviously, but I think it's more so just to put it into perspective of, like, even when it's an animal and it's serving a purpose, for me personally, I don't know that I have the capability to do that without having some kind of reservations about it. And so it takes a certain kind of person. I'm not saying that in a bad way. It takes a certain kind of person, and you need to be prepared for what you might have to do if you go into war. And I think that's the movie is a lot about that, you know?
Yeah. And you know, so something I want to point out to you early on is, so there was two interesting try to get back on track, off track, whatever. But I think it was funny that Bruce Willis was originally the first one that they wanted to play as Joker, and that Arnold Schwarzenegger, they wanted him to play Animal Mother. How different would this movie have been if Bruce Willis and Arnold Schwarzenegger were playing those two iconic roles? I mean, Animal Mother sticks out to everybody, and so does Joker. But imagine if it was Willis and Schwarzenegger in those roles.
What's interesting about that is I think I read the Bruce Willis thing. I don't think I read about the Schwarzenegger thing. And until you said Schwarzenegger's name, when you first said Bruce Willis's Joker, I was like, oh, I think that Bruce, I don't know if I could see Bruce Willis playing a role that's this, I don't want to say empathetic, but there's like almost some humorous moments. And when I think of Bruce Willis, I do think tough guy.
He'd almost be like a cowboy. He'd be like a cowboy. You know, I could see him playing cowboy or, you know, one of those first, recruits.
I could even see him playing Animal Mother.
Yeah.
Like, you know, going out for something like that. But I don't know that I could see him in a role that's kind of as, I don't want to say timid. I don't think of the best word to describe Joker's character, because it's a great performance. There, Matthew Modine, there's a lot of hesitation and reservation, and it's somebody, it is very realistic in the sense that he is playing somebody who is there, who is trying to convince themselves and the people around them that they are a leader and someone who is capable of doing what needs to be done in a you know, life or death situation.
Mm-hmm.
They clearly are just not that person.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's a great performance.
So another interesting thing, I mean, a lot of it too, I mean, we talk about how iconic the first half of this movie is, but also too, most of it you can't even repeat, or you don't even want to repeat. Like, it's definitely a movie of its time. And
yeah,
the funny thing is how much of that was ad-libbed or improv. That wasn't written. That was all him doing that to them, which makes it even funnier to sit back and watch it.
There are some very funny ad-libs. There's also some very offensive ones, kind of as you pointed out. But I also, that makes me feel like, I know, did you read about Arlie Ermey's, how he got this role?
I didn't read how he got it, but I know about him. I mean, he served in Vietnam.
It's interesting, because originally Kubrick said no and turned him down. He wanted the role, and Kubrick said no. And then he taped himself for it was like 2 hours or something, just like improvising these like insults, and sent the tape to Kubrick, and Kubrick said he was like genius for the role, so he gave it to him. And to make their reactions more realistic, the actors in those training sequences did not know what Arlie Ermey was going to say to them, and they did it over and over and over with all these different ad libs to try to get the best response out of the actors around him. But it is this thing where I was like, you know, obviously it's the 1967, I think. It makes sense, the things that he's saying, even though they are very offensive. It makes sense that somebody in the military at that time would say those things. And it makes me think that it's coming from a very real place, considering he actually served, you know, and fit that role so well.
And this is the first time that we're talking about Kubrick's filming style, too, with his actors. We didn't talk about The Shining at all or some of the other films where it was really problematic. But this took over a year to film, plus into consideration that he was not going to let him go and see the birth of his children.
None of this.
Oh, Modine, the actor that played Joker?
Yeah.
He was expecting children, and Kubrick wasn't going to let him go. He said, you don't need to be there for the birth of your children. It took over a year to film certain of these scenes because Ermey actually got into a car accident and broke his ribs.
That I did read.
So not only was this film tough because they're filming in, quote from the actors, very toxic environments that they were working in some of those filming sites, long hours, long filming sessions, those recruits in the film actually went through a different Marine boot camp for the to get ready for this part. They were continuously getting their heads shaved throughout the whole entire film.
That I read too. Yeah. That's...
And just thinking of this for over a year, dealing with Kubrick, getting your head shaved, getting yelled at by real Marines, being in the mud, the actual mud, and having toxic fumes from this plant that they were filming at. It just blows my mind. Like, I don't even, like, you couldn't do that these days. There's no way that you could do that. No way.
I'm. It's almost like Kubrick's like a method director. and there was this, I do think that that's kind of like bullshit. I mean, the thing is, you know, when I say that's bullshit, people are going to be like, yeah, but like, look at the results. And I agree. Like, Kubrick is, we wouldn't be covering him on the show if it wasn't such a, like a great filmmaker, an iconic filmmaker. But do you really think that greatness came from him being like a dick to everybody? I feel like he had this talent in him, and I'm not saying he was, I don't know if he was like a horrible person. I know he did some crappy stuff to some people that probably didn't deserve it, but to me, I'm just curious if it was really necessary for the shoot to get this movie exactly how it was. Like, I have to refuse to let Matthew Modine see the birth of his children, you know. But regardless, there was a quote about method acting I read the other day, and I just tried to find it, and I can't figure out who it was attributed to. But they were talking about, somebody was talking about method acting, and the person they were talking to brought up the fact that I suggest just acting. Like, that's the, like what are you method acting for? It's called acting because you are, you know,
that's a good point. Not real,
you know. So like, what is this thing you're doing where you're putting not only yourself but everyone around you through? If that's what you have to do to get a good performance, then maybe you shouldn't be an actor, you know. I don't know.
I think a lot of people, and this talks for any profession, I think there's the actors in any profession, and then there's the method actors that take it a little bit too far, you know. That's I kind of see that in every single profession. There's always the one or two people that just take the job, I don't want to say too seriously, because you should always take your job seriously, but just a little over the top, a little too, like,
well, yeah. I mean, it's
black and white about things.
It's the difference between taking your work seriously and making it a bad environment or situation for your coworkers, essentially, you know. We gotta talk about Gomer Pyle, because we can't do a Full Metal Jacket episode.
No, I figured we got some time to talk about Private Pyle for sure. I mean, we worked backwards, kind of, not intentionally, but it worked out well that we did it backwards. So.
Oh, we also did not know there were some things in this movie that I did not know came from this movie. One of which being, forgive me, I do not mean this in the, I'm quoting the film. I'm not going to say any horrible words. It's just the miso horny thing comes from this film, which I did not know, you know, made famous obviously by Sir Mix-a-Lot I almost said Miss New Booty. What? It's not bringing sexy, what's the Sir Mix-a-Lot song about butts, Jess?
Baby Got Back? Is that it?
What is it? Yeah, I like big butts, but what's the song called? Is it just called I Like Big Butts?
I think it's Baby Got Back, isn't it? I don't know. I'm not too hip on the...
it is. Jimmy, you're correct. It is called Baby Got Back, but this is hilarious. The album is called I Like Big Butts in quotes. Which is very funny.
You know, like, how to, I mean, that's a marketing genius right there. You know what the people want.
Right. The people listening to Sir Mix-a-Lot are like, that's me too.
Me too.
Before they pick up the CD. The miso horny thing. That's why I was bringing it up. Yeah, there's a lot of, and the second half of it is rough, obviously. That was the other thing before we get to Pyle real quick that I thought was interesting was, there the amount of not to be, I don't think anybody cares, I think I'm just making an observation, I'm not trying to be super liberal about anything, but the amount of racism and kind of sexism that was normalized in war, especially at that time, and then to have this teenage girl at the end of the movie be the one that's shooting at them, I thought was a really interesting choice. And that idea that it really humanizes the people that they're fighting, it is this moment, it makes it so profound because it humanizes the people that they're fighting.
Well, that too, and also like the Vietnam War, historically known for a war of the people. I mean, they didn't know who they were actually fighting. The majority, and that's when you see them on the, you know, one of the most iconic lines I think of this film is when Joker asked the gunner of the helicopter, he's like, "How do you kill women and children?" He's like, "Easy, you don't lead them as much." But
yeah,
that's speaks to the horrors of Vietnam, is that they truly didn't know who was the enemy. They didn't know, even though they're killing the women and children, they didn't know. And point proof, towards the end of the movie, the sniper was a teenage girl. You didn't know who the enemy was, and that was one of the biggest horrors of this film and the war, is just you didn't know who it was.
Right, and it led to, obviously, immeasurable civilian casualties, you know. Just a bad, again, the horrors of war. I mean, this movie really, that's kind of, like I said, I had this great experience watching the first half, I had a good experience watching the second half, and then the end of the film is really kind of just what wrapped it all up and pulled me back in to say, like, yeah, this is a movie that it feels like a Kubrick film, because I enjoyed the simplicity of it, honestly, because we talked so much about the themes of Clockwork Orange, that it was, and as much as I like that movie, it was great to watch something where it's like it's not even that it's on the nose. It's just it's such, so clearly war is filled with horror and murder and things that are awful to see and to know are happening. This is just a movie that wears its themes on its sleeve. It doesn't need to be as cerebral as other Kubrick films.
Yeah, and I think as far as take this away from being in a Kubrick film, as a war film, at least from my experience with them, they can be gruesome, they can show the horrors, but at the end of the day, there's a good guy. You know what I mean? A quote-unquote good guy. Something that's worth fighting for. There's a hero's journey with the country almost, and you feel fulfilled at the end of most of them. This one, though, there's no good guy. It's all just, you know, certain soldiers are the good guys. Joker, you can say, is like the quote hero of this film, but it just shows you like just the horror of it. It's not meant to show like a good side. It's not meant, and that's something you don't really see in a lot of, like, yeah, war
I'd
films.
Agree. There's no sense of, to me at least, again, I know that Kubrick said this wasn't an anti-war film, but there's no sense of like real like nationalism to this movie, yeah, or patriotism. It is, you know, like if you took out the fact that this was based on a real war and this was just a movie about two sides fighting, you would see Joker as a protagonist, but you wouldn't see him as a protagonist because he's out there being an action hero or being some kind of hero, in the field of war. You would see him as the protagonist because he's clearly somebody who's struggling with this, with the concept of war itself and this environment that he's in. And yeah, it's obviously it's a tragedy, because at the end of the movie, the only thing he gets out of this, out of everything, is the 1,000-yard stare.
He doesn't feel scared anymore.
Yeah,
it's 1,000 yards there, and he doesn't feel scared anymore. That's the biggest thing he gets from
that closing quote is like haunting. At first I like didn't know if I got it, because at first I was trying to I was like trying to decipher whether he was like glad that he had killed this person, or like what, you know, the quote being like, I live in a world of shit, but I'm not afraid anymore. You know, and in another context, saying that you're not afraid of something anymore would be a good thing, but I think in this sense, A, we know that Joker's kind of this he's like an ironic character, and he delivers kind of this ironic worldview on stuff. And I also think it's just like commenting on how it desensitizes you. You know, the whole first half of the movie is about brainwashing again, not trying to take any sides on the military issue, but it is just about this like loss of individuality and turning someone into kind of like the perfect soldier they can be. And still, you know, Joker is like fit to be in the field, and even though he's not infantry, he's goes through training and he graduates, and nothing, truly nothing, can prepare him for the effects of killing someone. You know. All right, we gotta talk about Pyle. These are tangents, but they're, I mean, these are good tangents, I feel like.
They're movie related tangents.
The Pyle stuff is awesome, and it's very good, very well done. It, again, does feel like a totally separate part from the second half of the movie, just because you could almost cut it in half and say that this first half of the movie is its own self-contained story about just the abuse that these soldiers are going through and how it leads one, you know, private to kill himself and to kill Arlie Ermes, to kill his sergeant, which was shocking to me. I had a feeling, again, I don't know if it's because I saw this before, if it's a pop culture thing, but I had an idea. I knew that Gomer Pyle was going to hurt himself. I did not remember or know that he was going to shoot the sergeant as well.
Yeah. I always think that there's another person that gets killed besides Arlie. Every time I watch it, it's like, I know it's him, but for some reason I always, it's just him and Pyle. But in my head, it's like Pyle, him, and one to two other people, and it's not.
Yeah,
it's
Joker's there. And he talks Pyle out of, obviously, I don't even know if Pyle was going to shoot him or not, but he talks Pyle into, I guess, not attacking him before Pyle ultimately turns the gun on himself.
Well, I think Pyle only wanted to kill himself. I think that was the true, I don't think that he wanted to shoot anyone else or harm anyone else, but when you see kind of the projection of his pain walk through the door and give it to him one last time, one last, you know, rib, and you know, Joker, he says to Joker, he's like, why aren't you throwing him on the floor? And he's like, well, it's my duty to inform the sergeant that he has live rounds in the gun. And you just see Arlie Ermey's face in that role just like immediately shift.
Man, you might have to edit this. Well, I'm trying to think of what I was going to say. I had something about this scene that I was going to add. This is Vincent D'Onofrio, right?
Yep.
Yeah, fantastic performance. Isn't it a shame what passed for fat guy back then?
he had to gain 70 pounds for this role.
You watch this, you're like, yeah, I think he looks fine. I think he looks okay.
I know, and when he's getting yelled at, he's like, you fat pile of shit, and I'm like, he's not that fat, right?
Yeah,
like,
I would be happy if I looked like him.
He's
this,
buff. I think he's pretty skinny. I don't know why you're calling him all those other guys are way too skinny. He's
rail
perfect
fit,
you know? He's yeah, perfect.
Exactly. We like a boy with meat on his bones here at after the movies. Man, I thought I had something I was gonna say about Gomer Pyle, and now it's gonna drive me nuts.
One of the most iconic lines in this film that even after the fifth time watching it still sent shivers down my spine is when it's such a convincing performance by Vincent. You know what I mean? He's sitting there and he's loading into his magazine. And he looks at Joker, and he just, obviously the title of the movie, but he's like, Full Metal Jacket, and puts it in. And every time I hear it, I'm just like, oh, like, I feel it. I feel that line. I feel the tenseness of that situation. I feel like I'm Joker in that, and just the, like, how would I react in a situation like that? I just immediately get transplanted in there. And I don't get that a lot from certain films.
We've talked about this before, too. You know, a very intense moment that in the hands of the wrong director could be seen as shock for shock's value, or it could be seen as, you know, not tasteful. But it is completely earned and effective in this movie. You know, that character's arc is... his death isn't, it's not just a death, it's not a suicide there that's shown on screen, which another thing that would be controversial today, I think.
Very gruesome.
Yes.
Suicide too. A very well done shot. Yeah, I hate to say it like that, but very well done as far as practical effects and stuff like
that. They don't shy away from showing the brutality of it. But again, it feels like it's not there for shock value. It's there to shock the audience in the sense that it's a horrible thing. Kind of the way the whole movie is set up to shock the audience in terms of like the horrors that they're experiencing, but it feels way more emotional, and the payoff is real because we just spent the past 40 minutes watching this guy be negged and abused
and beat down and
well that's what down. I was going to say, and that's what I had forgotten about, is the blanket party thing in this mm-hmm. movie, which I was not familiar with the term, but it you know, you obviously hear, I feel like I'm almost familiar with it because of jokes or something, where it's like kids in high school being like, like sock full of nickels or something like that. And I was unaware of how prevalent this practice was. And I did some research, and in 2015, there was a veteran that was diagnosed with PTSD after he had been a victim of a blanket party during training in the 1970s. So it seems like this was common practice. And that scene is disturbing and fascinating to me because it's physical pain, but it's not like this thing where it's like they're, you know, torturing the guy or anything, but it's also like, it's almost like this moment, this like pinnacle of like physical and emotional pain, just like coming to the surface where it's like, he's so upset about everything that's happening to him. He just has this conversation with Joker about how everything's my fault, everybody hates me. And so on top of what I'm sure does hurt, obviously, getting hit with, socks filled with soap and stuff, on top of that, it's just, like, validating his idea that, like, it is, like, the thing that essentially drives him to what at first, you know, Arlie Ermey thinks is him becoming the perfect soldier, but really it's this mental breakdown.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's been validated, this idea that everyone there hates him. Even Joker takes part in his abuse. And it's a really, I do think that's almost, I think maybe, you know, again, criticism, take that word very lightly because I think this movie's great, but I think it's hard almost to follow up this with the second half of the movie when that emotional heart of the film feels like it's really in that first half. It's almost hard to follow up Pyle's.
Well, you feel ripped out. Like you feel like you're just like you're ripped out of that so quick. You get that feeling, that gut, you just feel sick at the end of that scene. And then you're immediately transplanted into the first part of the Vietnam. Like, and that first part, that first maybe 3 or 4 minutes, 10 minutes, probably maybe longer, is like almost a comedy.
Right.
And then it's right after one of the most tragic parts of this movie. You get that like comedy element. And it's unnerving at first. Like when you go from that to that, you're just like, ooh.
Yeah. Yeah. Music choice too. I do. We should probably wrap up here, but I do want to mention the music choice reminds me of almost like kind of what Tarantino did with like Reservoir Dogs and Pulp Fiction. It feels like a precursor to that, where there's these well-known. They play Boots Are Made for Walking. They play these. It's the first time I've seen Kubrick. You know, or I'm thinking Clockwork Orange and a bit of the Ludwig van. But this is like him using popular songs for his movie, which I think is an interesting move. Mm.
And also, too, an interesting point on the music that I read earlier today, but Kubrick's daughter, Vivian Kubrick, under the alias Abigail Mead, wrote the film score as well. So that was a pretty interesting little
I wonder tidbit. How old she would have been at that time, and I wonder how old Kubrick was.
Well, she's 61 now, so in 87, she would have been 27.
Okay. That's cool. That's interesting. I would have to rewatch. Not to say the score was bad or anything, but my attention...
Not something that you pay attention to at all, definitely. I would agree with you on that. It's mostly those...
Yeah, not something that necessarily stood out, but I'd be curious to rewatch it and keep an ear out for it, you know?
Yeah, Kubrick was 60 when this film came out, so...
Okay. And if I was Matthew Modine, I would have punched his lights out. What's a 60-year-old fat dude, imagine,
Kubrick gonna dude, he's probably me? Scary, dude. Imagine talking back to Kubrick, dude. You'd be scared.
Worse Kubrick than Arlie Ermey.
Scary, man. Imagine Kubrick just hazing Arlie Ermey, though. It's the opposite.
Hey, blanket party Arlie Ermey. He's like, please. So, before we wrap up, you mentioned 1917 earlier. In terms of movies that are closer to this time period, war films, thinking maybe like Platoon, Saving Private Ryan. I've got a two-parter question for you. The first part is, how do you feel this compares to other war films that you've seen from kind of the around that time? And without giving too much away, because we always do this episode at the end of the season, how does this, because you've seen it so many times, how does this one kind of relatively stack up for you in terms of Kubrick films?
So as far as war movies are concerned, I said it earlier, I feel like there's always an agenda that's trying to be pushed, and not an agenda as far as like a political agenda. I mean, just the movie itself has an agenda. It's either whether or not it's actually two countries that exist or countries that don't exist. You're always rooting. There's always a bad guy and a good guy, but in this term, it's country versus country, and they can be gruesome. You can have like a hero's journey or a tragedy, whatever it is. But at the end of the day, you always feel like you were rooting for a country in a war movie. Yeah. In this one, you're not rooting for anybody. Like I said, you're really just seeing it happen. Kubrick does a really good job of transplanting you in. So I felt like, you know, not having served at all or anything like that, but I felt like I was involved in this film. I felt invested into the war and the, you know, how terrible it was and how terrible it was for everybody, you know, at both sides. So yeah, I just say it's just a really one-off depiction of how bad this war was and how bad it can be, and not like a glorified propaganda piece.
Definitely. Definitely. How does it feel compared to the other Kubrick stuff we've watched?
I mean, it's still, I would say I appreciate the killing a lot, just because it was an interesting movie and it really is memorable for me. But this movie, where we've seen in the past with some films that over time I like less and less. We talked about it with like No Country for Old Men. The more that we watch it, the less that it really sticks with us. I feel like the more that I watch Full Metal Jacket, the more it feels almost like a piece of me. Like it feels like a part of me.
Very
it's weird. It's weird feeling.
I'll be curious. I feel the same way about like something like Donnie Darko. So I will be very curious then to see kind of how our rankings turn out at the end of the season. So yeah. Let's wrap this thing. That was a great discussion. I again, not an expert in war films or war military history by any means, but really enjoyed this one.
Not even experts on film, but thanks for listening.
Very true. Great segue. If you love hearing non-experts on film talk about it at length, you can join our Patreon, patreon.com/LMOmedia. We got tiers as low as $3 a month. And for that, you can get video versions of our podcast episodes. Sometimes you get stuff early. Get bloopers, outtakes, photos from the content that we're making, working on, in addition to some a reward we haven't been able to do for a little bit, but once the holidays are over, hopefully get back to it, the watch parties of the films before we record the podcast, so you can watch the movie at the same time as us in the Discord server, and we can chat about it as we're watching the film. So would you do the honors and thank our current patrons?
Thank you, Dylan Painter. Thank you, Tyler Buckley. And thank you, J.E. Irvin. Your support is greatly appreciated. If you guys would like to join them, like Aaron said, patreon.com/LMOmedia and hang out with us. We would enjoy to have you.
Other ways you can support the show if you don't have the money, totally understand it's holiday season. Thank you, A, for listening. B, if you could tell a friend about the show. Word of mouth is great. Sharing the show on social media helps us out a bunch. Engaging with us on social media, if you like a certain episode, if you disagree with us on something, if you have a hot take you want to tweet at us, definitely reach out to us. We'd love to interact with people. And lastly, leaving us a review on Apple Music is super helpful and helps people find the show. All of those are free ways that you can support us.
Mm-hmm. Appreciate it.
I think that's about it today. We're going to be talking about Chris LaMartina, a director we love, I love at least. I'm very curious to know your thoughts, and especially on this movie. His most recent film, What Happens Next Will Scare You.
Love when we review these films. So
yes, another independent one. It's short. It's like 70 minutes. It's a bit of a throwback to WNUF. There's a lot of like found footage sequences within a full narrative kind of. So I'm super excited for you to watch it and for our listeners to watch it. I will do some research and post where you can watch it because I'm actually not quite sure where exactly it's available. I was a Kickstarter guy for it, so that's how I got my hands on a copy, but I'm sure that it is available somewhere. I'll do some research, I'll post on social media where you can watch it. And this brings me to next week, John Carpenter's In the Mouth of Madness, and the big holiday surprise, we will be having Ted Hallowell and Tim Murphy from No Hugging, No Learning on the show, everyone's favorite Seinfeld podcast. They'll be joining us to discuss a film that I had originally proposed for their Christmas special that I discovered, had no idea existed. It's called Santa with Muscles. And all you need to know, you can watch the trailer, you can do some Wikipedia research. It's an 80s film where Hulk Hogan plays a man dressed as Santa Claus. And that's as far as we'll go. You're going to have to listen to find out more about this hunk of shit, unless you watch it on YouTube where someone has uploaded a full VHS rip. So happy holidays. That'll be next week. And I hope you love or hate the movie, whichever would be more fun for you, I guess.
All right, everybody. Thanks for listening. See you in the next one.